little to develop into a kernel, but only if a grain of pollen can find its way to its ovary, a task complicated by the distance the pollen has to travel and the intervening husk in which the cob is tightly wrapped. To surmount this last problem, each flower sends out through the tip of the husk a single sticky strand of silk, technically its style, to snag its own grain of pollen. The silks emerge from the husk on the very day the tassel is set to shower its yellow dust. What happens next is very strange. After a grain of pollen has fallen through the air and alighted on the moistened tip of silk, its nucleus divides in two, creating a pair of twins, each with the same set of genes but a completely different role to perform in the creation of the kernel. The first twin's job is to tunnel a microscopic tube down through the center of the silk thread. Then its clone slides down through the tunnel, past the husk and into the waiting flower, a journey of between 6 and 8 inches that takes several hours to complete. Upon arrival in the flower, the second twin fuses with the egg to form the embryo, the germ of the future kernel. Then the first twin follows, entering the now fertilized flower, where it sets about forming the endosperm, the big, starchy part of the kernel. Every kernel of corn is the product of this intricate ménage à trois. The tiny, stunted kernels you often see at the narrow end of a cob are flowers whose silk no pollen grain ever penetrated. Within a day of conception, the now superfluous silk dries up, eventually turning reddish-brown. 50 or so days later, the kernels are mature. My account of the sex life of corn is drawn from Betty Fussell's The Story of Corn, 1992, and Frederick Sargent's Corn Plants, 1901. The mechanics of corn sex, and in particular the great distance over open space corn pollen must travel to complete its mission, go a long way toward accounting for the success of maize's alliance with humankind. It's a simple matter for a human to get between a corn plant's pollen and its flower, and only a short step from there to deliberately crossing one corn plant with another with an eye to encouraging specific traits in the offspring. Long before scientists understood hybridization, Native Americans had discovered that by taking the pollen from one corn plant's tassel and dusting it on the silks of another, they could create new plants that combined the traits of both parents. Indians were the world's first plant breeders, developing literally thousands of distinct cultivars for every conceivable use and environment. Put another way, corn was the first plant to involve humans so intimately in its sex life. For a species whose survival depends on how well it can gratify the ever-shifting desires of its only sponsor, this has proved to be an excellent evolutionary strategy. More even than other domesticated species, many of which can withstand a period of human neglect, it pays for corn to be obliging and to be so quick about it. The usual way a domesticated species figures out what traits its human ally will reward is through the slow and wasteful process of Darwinian trial and error. Hybridization represents a far swifter and more efficient means of communication, or feedback loop, between plant and human. By allowing humans to arrange its marriages, corn can discover in a single generation precisely what qualities it needs to prosper. It is by being so obliging that corn has won itself as much human attention and habitat as it has. The plant's unusual sexual arrangements, so amenable to human intervention, has allowed it to adapt to the very different worlds of Native Americans, and to their very different worlds, from southern Mexico to New England, of colonists and settlers and slaves, and of all the other corn-eating societies that have come and gone since the first human chanced upon that first Teosinte freak. But of all the human environments to which corn has successfully adapted since then, the adaptation to our own, the world of industrial consumer capitalism, the world that is of the supermarket and fast food franchise, surely represents the plant's most extraordinary evolutionary achievement to date. For to prosper in the industrial food chain to the extent it has, corn had to acquire several improbable new tricks. It had to adapt itself not just to humans, but to their machines, which it did by learning to grow as upright, stiff-stocked, and uniform as soldiers. It had to multiply its yield by an order of magnitude, which it did by learning to grow shoulder to shoulder with other corn plants, as many as 30,000 to the acre. It had to develop an appetite for fossil fuel, in the form of petrochemical fertilizer, and a tolerance for various synthetic chemicals. But even before it could master these tricks and make a place for itself in the bright sunshine of capitalism, corn first had to turn itself into something never before seen in the plant world, a form of intellectual property. The free corn sex I've described allowed people to do virtually anything they wanted with the genetics of corn except own them, a big problem for a would-be capitalist plant. If I crossed two corn plants to create a variety with an especially desirable trait, I could sell you my special seeds, but only once, since the corn you grew from my special seeds would produce lots more special seeds, for free and forever, putting me out of business within months. It's difficult to control the means of production when the product you're selling can reproduce itself endlessly. This is one of the ways in which the imperatives of biology are difficult to mesh with the imperatives of business. Difficult, but not impossible. Early in the 20th century, American corn breeders figured out how to bring corn reproduction under firm control and to protect the seed from copiers. The breeders discovered that when they crossed two corn plants that had come from inbred lines, from ancestors that had themselves been exclusively self-pollinated for several generations, the hybrid offspring displayed some highly unusual characteristics. First, all the seeds in that first generation, F1 in the plant breeder's vocabulary, produced genetically identical plants, a trait that, among other things, facilitates mechanization. Second, those plants exhibited heterosis, or hybrid vigor, better yields than either of their parents. But most important of all, they found that the seeds produced by these seeds did not come true. The plants in the second, F2 generation, bore little resemblance to the plants in the first. Specifically, their yields plummeted by as much as a third, making their seeds virtually worthless. Hybrid corn now offered its breeders what no other plant at that time could: the biological equivalent of a patent. Farmers now had to buy seeds every spring. Instead of depending upon their plants to reproduce themselves, they now depended on a corporation. The corporation, assured for the first time of a return on its investment in breeding, showered corn with attention. R&D, promotion, advertising, and the plant responded, multiplying its fruitfulness year after year. With the advent of the F1 hybrid, a technology with the power to remake nature in the image of capitalism, Z-Maize entered the industrial age and, in time, it brought the whole American food chain with it. Chapter 2. The Farm. One farmer, 129 eaters. To take the wheel of a clattering 1975 International Harvester tractor, pulling a spidery 8-row planter through an Iowa cornfield during the first week of May is like trying to steer a boat through a softly rolling sea of dark chocolate. The hard part is keeping the thing on a straight line. That, and hearing the shouted instructions of the farmer sitting next to you when you both have wads of Kleenex jammed into your ears to muffle the diesel roar. Driving a boat, you try to follow the compass heading or aim for a landmark on shore. Planting corn, you try to follow the groove in the soil laid down on the previous pass by a rolling disc at the end of a steel arm attached to the planter behind us. Deviate from the line and your corn rows will wobble, overlapping or drifting away from one another. Either way, it'll earn you a measure of neighborly derision and hurt your yield. And yield, measured in bushels per acre, is the measure of all things here in corn country. The tractor I was driving belonged to George Naylor, who bought it new back in the mid-70s, when, as a 27-year-old, he returned to Greene County, Iowa, to farm his family's 470 acres. Naylor is a big man with a moon face and a scraggly gray beard. On the phone, his gravelly voice and incontrovertible pronouncements, "That is just the biggest bunch of bullshit. Only the New York Times would be dumb enough to believe the Farm Bureau still speaks for the American farmers," led me to expect someone considerably more ornery than the shy fellow who climbed down from his tractor cab to greet me in the middle of a field in the middle of a slate-gray day threatening rain. Naylor had on the farmer's standard-issue baseball cap, a yellow chamois shirt and overalls, the stripy blue kind favored by railroad men, about as unintimidating an article of clothing as has ever been donned by a man. My first impression was more shambling, gentle Ben than fiery prairie populist, but I would discover that Naylor can be either fellow, the mere mention of Cargill or Earl Butts supplying the transformational trigger. This part of Iowa has some of the richest soil in the world, a layer of cakey alluvial loam nearly 2 feet thick. The initial deposit was made by the retreat of the Wisconsin Glacier 10,000 years ago, and then compounded at the rate of another inch or two every decade after by prairie grasses. Big bluestem, foxtail, needlegrass, and switchgrass. Tall grass prairie is what this land was until the middle of the 19th century, when the sod was first broken by the settler's plow.
George's grandfather moved his family to Iowa from Derbyshire, England, in the 1880s, a coal miner hoping to improve his lot in life.
The sight of such soil, pushing up and then curling back down behind the blade of his plow like a thick black wake behind a ship, must have stoked his confidence, and justifiably so. It's gorgeous stuff. Black gold as deep as you can dig, as far as you can see. What you can't see is all the soil that's no longer here, having been blown or washed away since the sod was broken. The 2-foot crust of topsoil here probably started out closer to 4.
End of Disc 1. Homo omnivorous. The fact that we humans are indeed omnivorous is deeply inscribed in our bodies, which natural selection has equipped to handle a remarkably wide-ranging diet. Our teeth are omnicompetent, designed for tearing animal flesh as well as grinding plants. So are our jaws, which we can move in the manner of a carnivore, a rodent, or a herbivore, depending on the dish. Our stomachs produce an enzyme specifically designed to break down elastin, a type of protein found in meat and nowhere else. Our metabolism requires specific chemical compounds that, in nature, can be gotten only from plants, like vitamin C, and others that can be gotten only from animals, like vitamin B12. More than just the spice of human life, variety for us appears to be a biological necessity. By comparison, nature's specialists can get everything they need from a small number of foods and, very often, a highly specialized digestive system, freeing them from the need to devote a lot of brain power to the challenges of omnivorousness. The ruminant, for example, specializes in eating grass, even though the grasses by themselves don't supply all the nutrients the animal needs. What they do supply is food for the microbes living in the animal's rumen, which in turn supply the other nutrients the animal needs to survive. The ruminant's genius for keeping itself well-fed resides in its gut rather than its brain. There does seem to be an evolutionary trade-off between big brains and big guts, two very different evolutionary strategies for dealing with the question of food selection. The case of the koala bear, one of nature's pickiest eaters, exemplifies the small brain strategy. You don't need a lot of brain circuitry to figure out what's for dinner when all you ever eat is eucalyptus leaves. As it happens, the koala's brain is so small it doesn't even begin to fill up its skull. Zoologists theorize that the koala bear once ate a more varied and mentally taxing diet than it does now, and that as it evolved toward its present, highly circumscribed concept of lunch, the bear's underemployed brain actually shrank. Food faddists take note. More important to the koala than brains is a gut big enough to break down all those fibrous leaves.
By the same token, the digestive tract of primates like us has grown progressively shorter as we've evolved to eat a more varied, higher quality diet. Eating might be simpler as a thimble-brained monophagy, but it's also a lot more precarious, which partly explains why there are so many more rats and humans in the world than koala bears. Should a disease or drought strike the eucalyptus trees in your neck of the woods, that's it for you. But the rat and the human can live just about anywhere on Earth, and when their familiar foods are in short supply, there's always another they can try. Indeed, there is probably not a nutrient source on Earth that is not eaten by some human somewhere. Bugs, worms, dirt, fungi, lichens, seaweed, rotten fish. The roots, shoots, stems, bark, buds, flowers, seeds, and fruits of plants. Every imaginable part of every imaginable animal, not to mention haggis, granola, and chicken McNuggets. The deeper mystery, only partly explained by neophobia, is why any given human group will eat so few of the numberless nutrients available to it. The price of this dietary flexibility is much more complex and metabolically expensive brain circuitry. For the omnivore, a tremendous amount of mental wiring must be devoted to sensory and cognitive tools for figuring out which of all these questionable nutrients it is safe to eat. There's just too much information involved in food selection to encode every potential food and poison in the genes. So instead of genes to write our menus, omnivores evolved a complicated set of sensory and mental tools to help us sort everything out. Some of these tools are fairly straightforward, and we share them with many other mammals. Others represent impressive feats of adaptation by primates. Still others straddle the blurry line between natural selection and cultural invention. The first tool is, of course, our sense of taste, which performs some of the basic work screening foods for value and safety. Or, as Briant Savarin put it in The Physiology of Taste, taste helps us to choose, from the various substances offered us by nature, those which are proper to be consumed. Taste in humans gets complicated, but it starts with two powerful instinctual biases, one positive, the other negative. The first bias predisposes us towards sweetness, a taste that signals a particularly rich source of carbohydrate energy in nature. Indeed, even when we're otherwise sated, our appetite for sweet things persists, which is probably why dessert shows up in the meal when it does. A sweet tooth represents an excellent adaptation for an omnivore whose big brain demands a tremendous amount of glucose, the only type of energy the brain can use, or at least it once did, when sources of sugar were few and far between. The adult human brain accounts for 2% of our body weight, but consumes 18% of our energy, all of which must come from a carbohydrate. Food faddists take note, too. Our sense of taste's second big bias predisposes us against bitter flavors, which is how many of the defensive toxins produced by plants happen to taste. Pregnant women are particularly sensitive to bitter tastes, probably an adaptation to protect the developing fetus against even the mild plant toxins found in foods like broccoli. A bitter flavor on the tongue is a warning to exercise caution lest a poison pass what Briant Savarin called the sense of taste's faithful sentries. Disgust turns out to be another valuable tool for negotiating the omnivore's dilemma. Though the emotion has long since attached itself to a great many objects having nothing to do with food, food is where and why it began, as the etymology of the word indicates. It comes from the Middle French verb dégoûter, to taste. Rosen, who has written or co-authored several fascinating articles about disgust, defines it as the fear of incorporating offending substances into one's body. Much of what people deem disgusting is culturally determined, but there are certain things that apparently disgust us all. And all these substances, Rosen notes, come from animals. Bodily fluids and secretions, corpses, decaying flesh, feces. Curiously, the one bodily fluid of other people that doesn't disgust us is the one produced by the human alone, tears. Consider the sole type of used tissue you'd be willing to share.
Disgust is an extremely useful adaptation since it prevents omnivores from ingesting hazardous bits of animal matter. Rotten meat that might carry bacterial toxins or infected bodily fluids. In the words of Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker, disgust is intuitive microbiology. Yet, helpful as it is, our sense of taste is not a completely adequate guide to what we can and cannot eat. In the case of plants, for instance, it turns out that some of the bitterest ones contain valuable nutrients, even useful medicines. Long before the domestication of plants, a process in which we generally selected for non-bitterness, early humans developed various other tools to unlock the usefulness of these foods, either by overcoming their defenses or overcoming our own aversion to how they taste. That's precisely what people must have done in the case of the sap in the opium poppy or the bark of the willow, both of which taste extremely bitter, and both of which contain powerful medicines. Once humans discovered the curative properties of salicylic acid in willows, the active ingredient in aspirin, and the relief from pain offered by the poppy's opiates, our instinctive aversion to these plants' bitterness gave way to an even more convincing cultural belief that the plants were worth ingesting even so. Basically, our powers of recognition, memory, and communication overcame the plants' defenses. Humans also learned to overcome plant defenses by cooking or otherwise processing foods to remove their bitter toxins. Native Americans, for example, figured out that if they ground, soaked, and roasted acorns, they could unlock the rich source of nutrients in the bitter nuts. Humans also discovered that the roots of the cassava, which effectively defends itself against most eaters by producing cyanide, could be made edible by cooking. By learning to cook cassava, humans unlocked a fabulously rich source of carbohydrate energy, one that, just as important, they had all to themselves, since locusts, pigs, porcupines, and all the other potential cassava eaters haven't yet figured out how to overcome the plant's defense. Cooking, one of the omnivore's cleverest tools, opened up whole new vistas of edibility. Indeed, in doing so, it probably made us who we are. By making these foods more digestible, cooking plants and animal flesh vastly increased the amount of energy available to early humans. And some anthropologists believe this boon accounts for the dramatic increase in the size of the hominid brain about 1.9 million years ago, around the same time our ancestors' teeth, jaws, and gut slimmed down to their present proportions, since they were no longer needed to process large quantities of raw food. By improving digestibility, cooking also cut down on the time we had to spend foraging for plants and simply chewing raw meat, freeing that time and energy for other pursuits. Last but not least, cooking abruptly changed the terms of the evolutionary arms race between omnivores and the species they would eat by allowing us to overcome their defenses. Apart from fruits, which have a declared interest in becoming another species' lunch, this being their strategy for spreading their seeds, and grasses, which welcome grazing as a strategy to keep their habitat free of shady competitors, most wild foods are parts of plants or animals that have no interest in being eaten. They evolve defenses to keep themselves whole. But evolution doesn't stand still, and eaters are constantly evolving counter-adaptations to overcome the defenses of nutrient sources. A new digestive enzyme to detoxify a plant or fungal poison, say, or a new perceptual skill to overcome an edible creature's camouflage. In response, the plants, animals, and fungi evolved new defenses to make themselves either more difficult to catch or to digest. This arms race between the eaters and the potentially eaten unfolded at a stately pace until early humans came on the scene. For a countermeasure such as cooking bitter plants completely changed the rules of the game. All at once, a species painstakingly developed defense against being eaten had been breached, and, assuming it can erect a new defense, that is going to take time. Evolutionary time. Cooking is often cited, along with tool-making and a handful of other proto-human tricks, as evidence that the human omnivore entered a new kind of ecological niche in nature, one that some anthropologists have labeled the cognitive niche. The term seems calculated to smudge the line between biology and culture, which is precisely the point. To these anthropologists, the various tools humans have developed to overcome the defenses of other species, not only food processing techniques, but a whole gamut of hunting and gathering tools and talents, represent biocultural adaptations, so called because they constitute evolutionary developments rather than cultural inventions that somehow stand apart from natural selection. In this sense, learning to cook cassava roots or disseminate the hard-won knowledge of safe mushrooms is not all that different from recruiting ruminal bacteria to nourish oneself. The cow depends on the ingenious adaptation of the rumen to turn an exclusive diet of grasses into a balanced meal. We depend instead on the prodigious powers of recognition, memory, and communication that allow us to cook cassava or identify an edible mushroom and share that precious information. The same process of natural selection came up with both strategies. One just happens to rely on cognition, the other goes with the gut. The anxiety of eating. Being an omnivore occupying a cognitive niche in nature is both a boon and a challenge, a source of tremendous power as well as anxiety. Omnivory is what allowed humans to adapt to a great many environments all over the planet, and to survive in them even after our favored foods were driven to extinction, whether by accident or because of our own too great success in overcoming other species' defenses. After the mastodon, there would be the bison and then the cow. After the sturgeon, the salmon, and then perhaps some novel microprotein like corn. Being a generalist offers us deep satisfactions too, enjoyments that flow equally from the omnivore's innate neophilia, the pleasure of variety, and neophobia, the comfort of the familiar. What began as a set of simple sensory responses to food, sweet, bitter, disgusting, we've elaborated into more complicated canons of taste that afford us aesthetic pleasures undreamed of by the koala or cow. Since everything that is edible is at the mercy of his vast appetite, Briat Savarin writes, the machinery of taste attains a rare perfection in man, making man the only gourmand in the whole of nature. Taste, in this more cultivated sense, brings people together, not only in small groups at the table, but as communities. For a community's food preferences, the strikingly short list of foods and preparations it regards as good to eat and think, represent one of the strongest social glues we have. Historically, national cuisines have been remarkably stable and resistant to change, which is why the immigrant's refrigerator is the very last place to look for signs of assimilation. Yet the surfeit of choice that confronts the omnivore brings stresses and anxieties also undreamed of by the cow or the koala, for whom the distinction between the good things to eat and the bad is second nature. And while our senses can help us draw the first rough distinctions between good and bad foods, we humans have to rely on culture to remember and keep it all straight. So we codify the rules of wise eating in an elaborate structure of taboos, rituals, manners, and culinary traditions, covering everything from the proper size of portions to the order in which foods should be consumed to the kinds of animals it is and is not okay to eat. Anthropologists argue over whether all these rules make biological sense. Some, like the kosher rules, are probably designed more to enforce group identity rather than to protect health. But certainly a great many of our food rules do make biological sense, and they keep each of us from having to confront the omnivore's dilemma every time we visit the supermarket or sit down to eat. That set of rules for preparing food we call a cuisine, for example, specifies combinations of foods and flavors that on examination do a great deal to mediate the omnivore's dilemma. The dangers of eating raw fish, for example, are minimized by consuming it with wasabi, a potent antimicrobial. Similarly, the strong spices characteristic of many cuisines in the tropics, where food is quick to spoil, have antibacterial properties. The Mesoamerican practice of cooking corn with lime and serving it with beans, like the Asian practice of fermenting soy and serving it with rice,
turn out to render these plant species much more nutritious than they otherwise would be. When not fermented, soy contains an antitrypsin factor that blocks the absorption of protein, rendering the bean indigestible. Unless corn is cooked with an alkali like lime, its niacin is unavailable, leading to the nutritional deficiency called pellagra. Corn and beans each lack an essential amino acid, lysine and methionine, respectively. Eat them together and the proper balance is restored. Similarly, a dish that combines fermented soy with rice is nutritionally balanced. As Rosen writes, cuisines embody some of a culture's accumulated wisdom about food. Often, when one culture imports another's food species without importing the associated cuisine and its embodied wisdom, they've made themselves sick. Rosen suggests that cuisines also help negotiate the tension between the omnivore's neophilia and neophobia. By preparing a novel kind of food using a familiar complex of flavors, by cooking it with traditional spices, say, or sauces, the new is rendered familiar, reducing the tension of ingestion. Anthropologists marvel at just how much cultural energy goes into managing the food problem. But as students of human nature have long suspected, the food problem is closely tied to, well, to several other big existential problems. Leon Cass, the ethicist, wrote a fascinating book called The Hungry Soul: Eating and the Perfection of Our Nature, in which he teases out the many philosophical implications of human eating. In a chapter on omnivorousness, Cass quotes at length from Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who in his second discourse on man draws a connection between our freedom from instinct in eating and the larger problem of free will. Rousseau is after somewhat bigger game in this passage, but along the way he offers as good a statement of the omnivore's dilemma as you're likely to find. Nature does everything in the operations of a beast, whereas man contributes to his operations by being a free agent. The former chooses or rejects by instinct and the latter by an act of freedom, so that a beast cannot deviate from the rule that is prescribed to it even when it would be advantageous to do so. And a man deviates from it often to his detriment. Thus a pigeon would die of hunger near a basin filled with the best meats, and a cat upon heaps of fruits or grain, although each could very well nourish itself on the food it disdains if it made up its mind to try some. Thus dissolute men abandon themselves to the excesses which cause them fever and death, because the mind depraves the senses, and because the will still speaks when nature is silent. Guided by no natural instinct, the prodigious and open-ended human appetite is liable to get us into all sorts of trouble, well beyond the stomachache. For if nature is silent, what's to stop the human omnivore from eating anything, including, most alarmingly, other human omnivores? A potential for savagery lurks in a creature capable of eating anything. If nature won't draw a line around human appetite, then human culture must step in, as indeed it has done, bringing the omnivore's eating habits under the government of all the various taboos, foremost the one against cannibalism, customs, rituals, table manners, and culinary conventions found in every culture. There is a short and direct path from the omnivore's dilemma to the astounding number of ethical rules with which people have sought to regulate eating for as long as they have been living in groups. Without virtue to govern his appetites, Aristotle wrote, man of all the animals is most unholy and savage, and worst in regard to sex and eating. Paul Rosen has suggested, only partly in jest, that Freud would have done well to build his psychology around our appetite for food rather than our appetite for sex. Both are fundamental biological drives necessary to our survival as a species, and both must be carefully channeled and socialized for the good of society. You can't just grab any tasty-looking morsel, he points out. But food is more important than sex, Rosen contends. Sex we can live without, at least as individuals, and it occurs with far less frequency than eating. Since we also do rather more of our eating in public, there has been a more elaborate cultural transformation of our relationship to food than there is to sex.
America's National Eating Disorder. Rosen doesn't say as much, but all the customs and rules culture has devised to mediate the clash of human appetite and society probably bring greater comfort to us as eaters than as sexual beings. Freud and others lay the blame for many of our sexual neuroses at the door of an overly repressive culture, but that doesn't appear to be the principal culprit in our neurotic eating. To the contrary, it seems as though our eating tends to grow more tortured as our culture's power to manage our relationship to food weakens. This seems to me precisely the predicament we find ourselves in today as eaters, particularly in America. America has never had a stable national cuisine. Each immigrant population has brought its own foodways to the American table, but none has ever been powerful enough to hold the national diet very steady. We seem bent on reinventing the American way of eating every generation, in great paroxysms of neophilia and neophobia. That might explain why Americans have been such easy marks for food fads and diets of every description. This is the country, after all, where at the turn of the last century, Dr. Harvey Kellogg persuaded great numbers of the country's most affluent and best educated to pay good money to sign themselves into his legendarily nutty sanitarium at Battle Creek, Michigan, where they submitted to a regime that included all grape diets and almost hourly enemas. Around the same time, millions of Americans succumbed to the vogue for Fletcherizing, chewing each bite of food as many as 100 times, introduced by Horace Fletcher, also known as the Great Masticator. This period marked the first golden age of American food faddism, though of course its exponents spoke not in terms of fashion, but of scientific eating, much as we do now. Back then, the best nutritional science maintained that carnivory promoted the growth of toxic bacteria in the colon. To battle these evildoers, Kellogg vilified meat and mounted a two-fronted assault on his patients' alimentary canals, introducing quantities of Bulgarian yogurt at both ends. It's easy to make fun of people who would succumb to such fads, but it's not at all clear that we're any less gullible. It remains to be seen whether the current Atkins school theory of ketosis, the process by which the body resorts to burning its own fat when starved of carbohydrates, will someday seem quaintly quackish as Kellogg's theory of colonic auto-intoxication. What is striking is just how little it takes to set off one of these apple cart-topping nutritional swings in America. A scientific study, a new government guideline, a lone crackpot with a medical degree can alter this nation's diet overnight. One article in the New York Times Magazine in 2002 almost single-handedly set off the recent spasm of carbophobia in America. But the basic pattern was fixed decades earlier and suggests just how vulnerable the lack of stable culinary traditions leaves us to the omnivore's anxiety and the companies and quacks who would prey on it. So every few decades, some new scientific research comes along to challenge the prevailing nutritional orthodoxy. Some nutrient that Americans have been happily chomping for decades is suddenly found to be lethal. Another nutrient is elevated to the status of health food. The industry throws its weight behind it, and the American way of dietary life undergoes yet another revolution. Harvey Levenstein, a Canadian historian who has written two fascinating social histories of American foodways, neatly sums up the beliefs that have guided the American way of eating since the heyday of John Kellogg. That taste is not a true guide to what should be eaten. That one should not simply eat what one enjoys. That the important components of food cannot be seen or tasted, but are discernible only in scientific laboratories. And that experimental science has produced rules of nutrition that will prevent illness and encourage longevity. The power of any orthodoxy resides in its ability not to seem like one, and, at least to a 1906 or 2006 genus American, these beliefs don't seem in the least bit strange or controversial. It's easy, especially for Americans, to forget just how novel this nutritional orthodoxy is, or that there are still cultures that, having been eating more or less the same way for generations,
relying on such archaic criteria as taste and tradition to guide them in their food selection. We Americans are amazed to learn that some of the cultures that set their culinary course by the lights of habit and pleasure, rather than nutritional science and marketing, are actually healthier than we are. That is, suffer a lower incidence of diet-related health troubles. The French paradox is the most famous such case, though, as Paul Rosen points out, the French don't regard the matter as paradoxical at all. We Americans resort to that term because the French experience, a population of wine-swilling cheese eaters with lower rates of heart disease and obesity, confounds our orthodoxy about food. That orthodoxy regards certain tasty foods as poisons, carbs now, fats then, failing to appreciate that how we eat and even how we feel about eating may in the end be just as important as what we eat. The French eat all sorts of supposedly unhealthy foods, but they do it according to a strict and stable set of rules. They eat small portions and don't go back for seconds. They don't snack. They seldom eat alone, and communal meals are long, leisurely affairs. In other words, the French culture of food successfully negotiates the omnivore's dilemma, allowing the French to enjoy their meals without ruining their health. Perhaps because we have no such culture of food in America, almost every question about eating is up for grabs. Fats or carbs? Three squares or continuous grazing? Raw or cooked? Organic or industrial? Veg or vegan? Meat or mock meat? Foods of astounding novelty fill the shelves of our supermarket, and the line between a food and a nutritional supplement has fogged to the point where people make meals of protein bars and shakes. Consuming these neo-pseudo-foods alone in our cars, we have become a nation of antinomian eaters, each of us struggling to work out our dietary salvation on our own. Is it any wonder Americans suffer from so many eating disorders? In the absence of any lasting consensus about what and how and where and when to eat, the omnivore's dilemma has returned to America with an almost atavistic force. This situation suits the food industry just fine, of course. The more anxious we are about eating, the more vulnerable we are to the seductions of the marketer and the expert's advice. Food marketing in particular thrives on dietary instability and so tends to exacerbate it. Since it's difficult to sell more food to such a well-fed population, though not, as we're discovering, impossible, food companies put their efforts into grabbing market share by introducing new kinds of highly processed foods, which have the virtue of being both highly profitable and infinitely adaptable. Sold under the banner of convenience, these processed foods are frequently designed to create whole new eating occasions, such as in the bus on the way to school, the protein bar or Pop-Tart, or in the car on the way to work. Campbell's recently introduced a one-handed microwavable micro-chunked soup in a container designed to fit a car's cup holder. The success of food marketers in exploiting shifting eating patterns and nutritional fashions has a steep cost. Getting us to change how we eat over and over again tends to undermine the various social structures that surround and steady our eating. Institutions like the family dinner, for example, or taboos on snacking between meals and eating alone. In their relentless pursuit of new markets, food companies, with some crucial help from the microwave oven, which made cooking something even small children could do, have broken mom's hold over the American menu by marketing to every conceivable demographic, and especially to children. A vice president of marketing at General Mills once painted for me a picture of the state of the American family dinner, courtesy of video cameras that the company's consulting anthropologists paid families to let them install in the ceiling above the kitchen and dining room tables. Mom, perhaps feeling sentimental about the dinners of her childhood, still prepares a dish and a salad that she usually winds up eating by herself. Meanwhile, the kids, and Dad too, if he's around, each fix something different for themselves, because Dad's on a low-carb diet, the teenagers become a vegetarian, and the 8-year-old is on a strict ration of pizza that the shrink says it's best to indulge, lest she develop eating disorders later on in life. So over the course of a half hour or so, each family member roams into the kitchen, removes a single portion entree from the freezer, and zaps it in the microwave. Many of these entrees have been helpfully designed to be safely cooked by an 8-year-old. After the sound of the beep, each diner brings his microwavable dish to the dining room table, where he or she may or may not cross paths with another family member at the table for a few minutes. Families who eat this way are among the 47% of Americans who report to pollsters that they still sit down to a family meal every night. Several years ago, in a book called The Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism, sociologist Daniel Bell called attention to the tendency of capitalism, in its single-minded pursuit of profit, to erode the various cultural underpinnings that steady a society, but often impede the march of commercialization. The family dinner, and more generally a cultural consensus on the subject of eating, appears to be the latest such casualty of capitalism. These rules and rituals stood in the way of the food industry's need to sell a well-fed population more food through ingenious new ways of processing, packaging, and marketing it. Whether a stronger set of traditions would have stood up better to this relentless economic imperative is hard to say. Today, America's fast food habits are increasingly gaining traction, even in places like France. So we find ourselves as a species almost back where we started. Anxious omnivores struggling once again to figure out what it is wise to eat. Instead of relying on the accumulated wisdom of a cuisine, or even on the wisdom of our senses, we rely on expert opinion, advertising, government food pyramids, and diet books. And we place our faith in science to sort out for us what culture once did with rather more success. Such has been the genius of capitalism. To recreate something akin to a state of nature in the modern supermarket or fast food outlet, throwing us back on a perplexing, nutritionally perilous landscape, deeply shadowed again by the omnivore's dilemma. Chapter 17. The Ethics of Eating Animals. The Steakhouse Dialogues. The first time I opened Peter Singer's Animal Liberation, I was dining alone at the Palm, trying to enjoy a ribeye steak cooked medium rare. If that sounds like a recipe for cognitive dissonance, if not indigestion, well, that was sort of the idea. It had been a long time since this particular omnivore had felt any dilemma about eating meat, but then I had never before involved myself so directly in the process of turning animals into food. Owning a steak-bound steer, working the killing cones in Joel Salatin's processing shed, and now preparing to hunt a wild animal. The steak dinner in question took place on the evening before steer number 534's slaughter, the one event in his life I was not allowed to witness or even learn anything about, save its likely date. This didn't exactly surprise me. The meat industry understands that the more people know about what happens on the kill floor, the less meat they're likely to eat. That's not because slaughter is necessarily inhumane, but because most of us would simply rather not be reminded of exactly what meat is or what it takes to bring it to our plates. My steak dinner, eaten in the company of the world's leading philosopher of animal rights, represented my somewhat tortured attempt to mark the occasion and to try, a bit belatedly I know, to see if I could defend what I had done already and what I was about to do. Eating meat has become morally problematic, at least for people who take the trouble to think about it. Vegetarianism is more popular than it has ever been, and animal rights, the fringiest of fringe movements until just a few years ago, is rapidly finding its way into the cultural mainstream. I'm not completely sure why this should be happening now, given that humans have been eating animals for tens of thousands of years without too much ethical heartburn. Certainly there have been dissenters over the years. Ovid, St. Francis, Tolstoy, and Gandhi come to mind. But the general consensus has always been that humans were indeed omnivores, and whatever spiritual or moral dilemmas the killing and eating of animals posed, our various cultural traditions, everything from the rituals governing slaughter to saying grace before the meal, resolved them for us well enough. For the most part, our culture has been telling us for millennia that animals were both good to eat and good to think. In recent years, medical researchers have raised questions about the good to eat part, while philosophers like Singer and organizations like People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA, have given us new reasons to doubt meat is good to think. That is, good for our souls or our moral self-regard. Hunting is in particularly bad odor these days, even among people who still eat meat. Apparently, it's the fact of killing these people most object to, as if a steak could be gotten any other way, or perhaps it's the taking pleasure in killing an animal that is the trouble. It may be that as a civilization we're groping toward a higher plane of consciousness. It may be that our moral enlightenment has advanced to the point where the practice of eating animals, like our former practices of keeping slaves or treating women as inferior beings, can now be seen for the barbarity it is, a relic of an ignorant past that very soon will fill us with shame. That, at least, is the animal philosopher's wager. But it could also be that the cultural norms and rituals that used to allow people to eat meat without agonizing about it have broken down for other reasons. Perhaps as the sway of tradition in our eating decisions weakens, habits we once took for granted are thrown up in the air, where they're most easily buffeted by the force of a strong idea or the breeze of fashion. Whatever the cause, the effect is an unusual amount of cultural confusion on the subject of animals. For at the same time many of us seem eager to extend the circle of our moral consideration to other species, in our factory farms we're inflicting more suffering on more animals than at any time in history. One by one, science is dismantling our claims to uniqueness as a species, discovering that such things as culture, tool-making, language, and even possibly self-consciousness are not, as we used to think, the exclusive properties of Homo sapiens. And yet most of the animals we eat lead lives organized very much in the spirit of Descartes, who famously claimed that animals were mere machines, incapable of thought or feeling. There's a schizoid quality to our relationship with animals today in which sentiment and brutality exist side by side. Half the dogs in America will receive Christmas presents this year, yet few of us ever pause to consider the life of the pig, an animal easily as intelligent as a dog, that becomes the Christmas ham. We tolerate the schizophrenia because the life of the pig has moved out of view. When's the last time you saw a pig in person? Meat comes from the grocery store, where it is cut and packaged to look as little like parts of animals as possible. When was the last time you saw a butcher at work? The disappearance of animals from our lives has opened a space in which there's no reality check on the sentiment or the brutality. It is a space in which the Peter Singers and the Frank Perdues of the world fare equally well. A few years ago, the English writer John Berger wrote an essay called Why Look at Animals, in which he suggested that the loss of everyday contact between ourselves and animals, and specifically the loss of eye contact, has left us deeply confused about the terms of our relationship to other species. That eye contact, always slightly uncanny, had brought the vivid daily reminder that animals were both crucially like and unlike us. In their eyes we glimpsed something unmistakably familiar, pain, fear, courage, but also something irretrievably other. Upon this paradox, people built a relationship in which they felt they could both honor and eat animals without looking away. But that accommodation has pretty much broken down. Nowadays, it seems we either look away or become vegetarians. For my own part, neither option seemed especially appetizing. Certainly, looking away was now completely off the table. Which might explain how it was I found myself attempting to read Peter Singer in a steakhouse. This is not something I'd recommend if you're determined to continue eating meat. Animal liberation, comprised of equal parts philosophical argument and journalistic description, is one of those rare books that demands you either defend the way you live or change it. Because Singer is so skilled in argument, for many readers it is easier to change. Animal liberation has converted countless thousands to vegetarianism, and it didn't take me long to see why. Within a few pages, he had succeeded in throwing me and my meat-eating, not to mention my hunting plans, on the defensive. Singer's argument is disarmingly simple and, provided you accept its premises, difficult to refute. Take the premise of equality among people, which most of us readily accept. Yet what do we really mean by it? After all, people are not, as a matter of fact, equal at all. Some are smarter than others, handsomer, more gifted, whatever. Equality is a moral idea, Singer points out, not an assertion of fact. The moral idea is that everyone's interests ought to receive equal consideration, regardless of what they are like or what abilities they have. Fair enough. Many philosophers have gone this far. But few have then taken the next logical step. If possessing a higher degree of intelligence does not entitle one human to use another for his or her own ends, how can it entitle humans to exploit non-humans for the same purpose? This is the nub of Singer's argument, and right away, here on page 6, I began scribbling objections in the margin. But humans differ from animals in morally significant ways. Yes, they do, Singer readily acknowledges, which is why we shouldn't treat pigs and children alike. Equal consideration of interests is not the same as equal treatment, he points out. Children have an interest in being educated, pigs in rooting around in the dirt. But where their interests are the same, the principle of equality demands they receive the same consideration. And the one all-important interest humans share with pigs, as with all sentient creatures, is an interest in avoiding pain. Here Singer quotes a famous passage from Jeremy Bentham, the 18th-century utilitarian philosopher. Bentham is writing in 1789, after the French had freed their black slaves and granted them fundamental rights, but before the British or Americans had acted. "The day may come," Bentham wrote, "when the rest of the animal creation may acquire those rights." Bentham then asks what characteristics entitle any being to moral consideration. "Is it the faculty of reason, or perhaps the faculty of discourse?" Bentham asks. "But a full-grown horse or dog is beyond comparison a more rational, as well as a more conversational animal than an infant." The question is not, can they reason, nor can they talk, but can they suffer? Bentham here is playing a powerful card philosophers call the argument from marginal cases, or AMC for short. It goes like this. There are humans, infants, the severely retarded, the demented, whose mental function does not rise to the level of a chimpanzee. Even though these people cannot reciprocate our moral attentions, obey the golden rule, etc., we nevertheless include them in the circle of our moral consideration. So on what basis do we exclude the chimpanzee? "Because he's a chimp," I furiously scribble in the margin, "and they're human beings." For Singer, that's not good enough. To exclude the chimp from moral consideration simply because he's not human is no different than excluding the slave simply because he's not white. In the same way we'd call that exclusion racist, the animal rightist contends it is speciesist to discriminate against the chimpanzee solely because he's not human. But the differences between blacks and whites are trivial compared to the differences between my son and the chimp. Singer asks us to imagine a hypothetical society that discriminates on the basis of something non-trivial. Intelligence, say. If that scheme offends our sense of equality, as it surely does, then why is the fact that animals lack this or that human characteristic any more just as a basis for discrimination? Either we do not owe any justice to the severely retarded, he concludes, or we do owe it to animals with higher capabilities. This is where I put down my fork. If I believe in equality, and equality is based on interests rather than characteristics, then either I have to take the steer's interest into account or accept that I'm a speciesist. For the time being, I decided, I'll plead guilty as charged. I finished my steak. But Singer had planted a troubling notion, and in the days afterward it grew and grew, watered by the other animal rights thinkers I began reading. The philosophers Tom Regan and James Rachels, the legal theorist Stephen M. Wise, writers like Joy Williams and Matthew Scully. I didn't think I minded being called a speciesist, but could it be, as these writers suggest, we will someday come to regard speciesism as